Hi, this is Paul. For the last number of days, I've been trying to get my head around, probably the last number of weeks, trying to get my head around how to approach the questions that I've been wrestling with. And perhaps the definition of secular is the best way to go about it. Before my little break, I was listening to a lot of Stephen Smith and his book, Pagans and Christians in the City. Dominion, of course, has been on the radar for a long time. Just recently, Mere Orthodoxy did a very interesting piece about individualism, which put me better aware of the work of Mark Sayers. Mark Sayers is an Australian pastor, and he was doing a podcast with another pastor in Portland. And of course, Andrew Root's work, I think, is very important in his application of Charles Taylor to the church scene, the pastor in a secular age. And so all of this is sort of coming together in the idea of the secular. Now, as many of you know, I've been working on a chapter. Initially, I wrote a draft, and then just with COVID everything, I didn't really feel I could adequately address the chapter. And so one of the things that I did, I kind of turned it back over to John Vervaeke and Christopher Mastropietro, and they edited it, and I think really added to the chapter in some really profound ways. And then I did a little bit of re-editing, and I turned it back to them, and all three of us are quite happy with the chapter. And in it, I explored, this was in April when I was writing this, early April or late March, right when COVID was hitting. I was really exploring the question of, well, how do we piece this whole thing together? How do we understand the transition from the ancient world to the ancient medieval synthesis to the Reformation to modernity and what's happening now? And secular is sort of a way to bridge this gap. Now, the definition of secular that I began my YouTube odyssey with had everything to do with, I think, the emergence of Jordan Peterson marking, in some ways, not only the end of the secular age, but some little insights into what the next phase might look like. And I think Jordan, much more than any of the other IDW, and in many ways, I see many of the members of the IDW as classical liberals. That's how Peterson represents himself, but also recalcitrant modernists that, in a way similar to what the church has been doing for the last 500 years in terms of fighting a rear guard effort against modernity and secularism, these people are trying to preserve it. And what they're trying to preserve are the Enlightenment assumptions of the definition of the secular. And it's, most of you recognize it easily. It's in many ways the philosophical assumptions upon which American secularity is based, an American secularity that spread throughout the world over the last 200 years. You know, Jonathan Peugeot remains a monarchist, and he lives in a land of a queen, but the secular paradigm has conquered. But now it is receding. And now, the recession, these recessions, they take hundreds of years to actually play out. But we are seeing, and one might argue that the recession began in the killing fields of World War I and was emphasized and hammered by the Second World War and the Cold War and communism and fascism and all of these elements. But the outlines of it are clear to any of us. This kind of obvious, facile understanding of the secular and the religious, of you know, secular religion has God and holy books and myth and supernatural and those kinds of things, and secular has science and facts and the public space. The secular means religion free. The secular is just normal life without this distorting ancient accommodation system that primitive people needed in order to try to explain the world. You know, that's a vision that, say, Sam Harris would articulate. So you not only have freedom of religion, which is, let's say, the 18th century idea, and continuing to struggle past the continuous wars between Protestants and Catholics, but the freedom from religion idea, which emerges in the 19th and 20th and 21st century, that was sufficient to create billboards in Sacramento, religion free and still having wonder available to it, and meaning, if one understands meaning within the immanent frame, within the buffered self, that meaning is something that I feel. Now, of course, John Vervaeke's approach to meaning, it being something that is co-generated, and that's very much, I mean, if you watch John do the hand thing, I mean, that's, in some ways, that's John. It's the back and forth. It's the inside outside. Whereas very early on, someone made the observation to be that you know, part of Jordan Peterson's contribution was very much a both and religion and secularity, religion and science. You know, Vervaeke, I think, in a sense, takes it a little bit further in terms of understanding how it's not a Kantian perspective of sort of a static, the static internal framework, but it's the reality with cognitive science that the internal framework and the external context are continually in a relationship of co-development. It's the interplay of emanation from above and emergence from below. And that came out in our most recent conversation, the conversation between myself and Jonathan Peugeot and John Vervaeke. And in that conversation, I, you know, going into it, having watched the prior conversation between John and Jonathan, where they both really got stuck. And what I wanted to do going into that conversation was sort of facilitate them to get beyond their impasse. It doesn't mean that they're changing their positions necessarily. You know, Jonathan Peugeot is an extraordinarily traditional theist, and John Vervaeke is a highly educated, articulate non-theist, and neither. Neither changed nor, I think, betrayed their positions, but finding that middle space in between where the two can perhaps, via dialogos, find treasures and riches that they can take from the conversation. Okay? So again, back to the established and assumed definition of secular in the modern frame. Secular means regular life without God or church, or maybe spirituality. Spirituality within the realm of the buffered self becomes a privatized, you know, spiritual but not religious in a secular frame is in some ways parallel to the wonder and meaning the freedom from religion people can have. It's similar to the moves that, like Stories of Old, in his little trilogy on story and humanity and anthropology. Well, just because, now this is so deeply embedded in modernity, just because we know my life isn't a story, okay, so you presume that the modern framework, just because we know my life isn't a story. Now, John Vervaeke might say, well, that's not a presumption of the modern framework, because he has that presumption as well. Can't touch the mic. Just because we know my life isn't a story, still, I can experience it as story. My question is, yeah, but you you can, in the moments of the dark movie theater, forget your confessional position that life is not a story and imagine your life is a story. Well, again, as a Christian minister, in some ways, I mean, what do I bring to the table? I'm not a philosopher. I'm not an academic. I'm not an artist. What Christian ministers are curators and observers on the scene of how regular people work this out. Was Mrs. Falwell betraying her Christianity when she's, taking advantage of her son's sports friends who are sleeping in the guest room? And of course, the experience of a young man being pleasured by a more mature woman is often quite different from the experience of a young woman being uninvitedly pleasured by, let's say, if the Falwells' daughters had friends over in the guest room and Jerry Falwell had come in to, Jerry Falwell Jr. had come in to pleasure a young lady, well, that script is set. And there would be the public conversation on that topic would be very different. But because it's Becky Falwell doing this to young men, well, it's different because men and women are different. But where was I going with this? Secular means regular life without God or church or maybe spirituality. And so people, Christians regularly in some ways forget who they are. They forget that they're Christians and they're part of why the symbolism of the Falwell fall is so powerful is because the way it plays out in the public imaginary is that this is just yet another example of how traditional Christian sexual morality is unnatural and unworkable, even though the critics really struggle to actually provide a coherent, stable, long-lasting, scalable framework of their own. Just having it be ad hoc doesn't really cut it. So the definition of secular is perhaps a way into this. Now, in my last video, I talked about hurricanes and the judgment of God, and in some ways, that issue nicely gets us into this. When Hurricane Katrina hit, Pat Robertson went on the 700 Club and basically declared that this was God's judgment against the United States because of the public sin of abortion. Now, the irony in so many hurricanes are that they so regularly strike the states that are most against abortion. You know, Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, Florida, Georgia, North and South Carolina. I mean, that's who always gets whacked with the hurricanes, and these are the states that, you know, would be able to, you know, if without all the other states, they would have far stronger laws against abortion just by virtue of the politics there. So hurricanes, Pat Robertson declared in 2005, were again part of God's judgment against the United States. Many saw in 2001 the attacks of 9/11 as, you know, our protective covering that we had upon us by virtue of our allegiance to God and the purity and of our laws had been withdrawn. And for this reason, attacks were coming against the United States. In other words, but now what does the narrative look like? God or the gods are conscious of human sin and rebellion and his or their anger, and in his or their anger, they punish the individuals or humanity for disobedience and lawlessness. You can find these ideas in Homer. You can find them in the Bible. You can find them in the sack of Rome. This pattern of understanding events on the ground in the seculum with events in the heavens long predates Christianity. And in my chapter with Verveke and Christopher, I went into that a little bit more, and maybe I'll go into some of those ideas in some upcoming videos as well. But this is a common, nearly universal human narrative. And it endures today, even amongst highly secularized people. Somebody's life falls apart. If they're a Christian, they'll say, "Where is God? God was supposed to protect me." Even many people who are deeply secular will have ideas of, well, you know, I must have, what did you do wrong? You know, and our good fortune happens, and there's all these little sayings. You know, that's a result of clean living. You know, all of the, basically the idea is that the moral and the existential are the reputation we have with the gods is reflected by the circumstances of our lives. It's basically karma. And this is far beyond Christianity. This is simply a universal assumption that in many ways secularity attempts to resist. The world is disenchanted. It's demythologized. Events don't happen for a reason. There is no reason. That's in some ways the crowning centerpiece of secularity. Now, and so when Pat Robertson says this, people mock and scoff, and in fact many Christian leaders will wade into the mix and say, "No, where was God when the tsunami where was God when the tsunami hit Indonesia?" Well, God was amongst the victims. Where was God on 9/11? And you can find a piece of art with Jesus standing cruciform between the Twin Towers. Jesus identifies and associates with the suffering. Jesus is the victim of the 9/11 attacks. Now, Christianity is enormously flexible. I don't know if there's ever been a religion that can be as contortionist as Christianity, because God plays the judgment enforcer and the victim in some ways. And I got to be careful with that language theologically, because there's a great deal of theology that goes into that conversation. But, you know, so God, and of course the new atheists have made big work of these. So God beats his son in order to forgive you. Well, what sense does that make? That sounds pathological. That sounds completely abusive. But we have to go back to this ancient understanding of how we make meaning from both the fortunes and disasters of our lives. Tom Holland, again, a number of years ago, began to recognize that for as religious as the ancient world seemed to be, you know, the pyramids and the temples of Egypt, the temples of Greece, the sacrifices, the temples of Central America, you know, when we seculars look back at the ancient world, it looks pervasively religious. You simply did not see anything in the secular realm that wasn't shot through with what we identify as, from this modernistic secular point of view, don't identify as religiosity. And so Tom Holland noticed that ancients didn't self-consciously have a religion. Judaismo, Judaism, almost always religions are labeled by their adversaries, such as in Antioch, where Christians are first called Christians. And, you know, Judaismo, the religion of the Jews. Well, every ethnic group has their own god. That was simply the assumption of the ancient world. And you followed the gods of your city or your tribe or the land or the aspect that, or your guild or what have you. That was simply how the world worked. And so, you know, in some ways, when Sam Harris calls religion ancient science, he has a point to the degree that these were the assumed ways that the world works. And he also has a point that in some ways science displaced that. What he fails to see is that in displacing a religion, you don't actually remove the category of religion, you become a religion. So in the ancient world, religious practices such as sacrifices being offered were done in order to manage the chaotic, unruly, or demanding nature of the gods, in order to secure order, power, favor for cities, individuals, societies, and human beings. That's why you did sacrifices. And King Agamemnon sacrifices his daughter in order to secure fair winds. And you might say, well, why would a Greek god desire the sacrifice of a virgin? Well, why throw virgins into volcanoes? Well, and again, from a secular point of view, there's no causality. Why would abortion policy impact hurricanes? But it's, on the other hand, it just seems so obvious to us why all kinds of other policies, including racial policies, impact climate change. That's just obvious. But the linkage between abortion and hurricanes? Well, that makes no sense. Well, it all depends how you believe the linkages are made. You know, and again, as the comment I made in the video yesterday, one might very easily argue that abortion policy and climate change are in fact linked, if in fact you can abort enough babies and reduce and retard the population sufficiently as to relieve the climate of hosting just so many human beings and all of our gadgets and technologies that have saved us and encouraged us away from the gods. So they didn't have a religion, but they were always sacrificing and looking at oracles and having magi and wise men, and they were pervasively, consistently, extraordinarily religious, and almost all of the cultural artifacts we look at the pyramids and say, those are just pyramids, they're not religious. No, it was their religious symbolic world that drove them to build the pyramids and the Sphinx and the temples. And that's why in these populations and at these times when people struggled to eat, struggled to have the basic necessities of life secured, they poured an enormous percentage of their gross domestic product into religious products. And wonders and monuments. Why was religiosity so expensive in the ancient world? Well, it was no less expensive than the dams we build or the science we discover. We're not waiting. The churches are non-essential in a pandemic, but you know, the scientists are essential. And, you know, now suddenly we don't care the skin color of the scientists finding the vaccine. We want a vaccine that works. So, you know, and all the talk of, well, religion or you know, science being white and math being white. Well, give me some of that white man vaccine anti-COVID juice, please. You know, I'll be a white supremacist for as long as I can get it in my arm. Or I'm not going to take that because probably the vaccines are simply another... Just wait, this argument will come up. You can predict this stuff. You just follow the contour lines of their thinking and, well, the vaccines are an attempt to subjugate the black man. Well, there you go. I mean, it's going to come up. But even in the ancient world, the Jews show up on the scene and Israel's religion, you know, it's definitely in context with the ancient world, but her religion wasn't distinct from the religions of the other nations only in the number of gods. And I think for most of my life, the understanding of the differentiation between monotheism and polytheism, though that was basic. Well, and you find that even in Jordan Peterson's treatment of monotheism and polytheism, that there's basically a gradual subsumption of the gods into sort of a rational, logical perspective that, well, it can all be located in one God. And there's an element of the story that's correct there, but historically, that idea is increasingly under threat and increasingly being undermined. And that undermining of it has been happening for almost 100 years now. And again, Kaufman's book, Israel had no mythology. And what did he mean by that? What did Kaufman mean by that? There's no birth of the gods in the Bible. The Bible begins, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. In other words, the Hebrew God comes before heaven and earth. Now, that's not unusual in mythology, but there's no saying where the gods come from. And there's one. The Hebrews are, you know, are they henotheists? Are they recovering polytheists? Well, they're swimming in polytheistic soup, but there's this tension that continues to build, you know, from a very ancient place. And, you know, there's a reason Athens and Jerusalem are shown, because in some ways, you know, Plato has some of this and Israel has some of this, but there's this one God of Israel, and he calls creation into being with his word. And he brings with his word, he brings ordered, productive creation out of the chaotic tohu wavohu. Israel's creation story presents its deity creating and maintaining an orderly good cosmos, not a society of conscious, willful gods that require relational maintenance. Now, again, read Michael Heiser. The Old Testament clearly has the Lord above all gods. You can find it in the Psalms, and as much sort of papering over that as highly modernistic translations of the Bible have tried to do, because suddenly, well, we'll call them the heavenly hosts and let moderns really believe in angels. Because, again, there's, when I was, you know, my conversation with Jesse was important, because I recognize how much some of my missionary training and the anthropology, you know, that I read and received in that training aspect. Most traditional worldviews have three tiers. There's sort of the high God, and then there's the gods in between, and then there's the people. And the high God can be sort of the meta-divine realm, and then the gods, and then the people. Well, what happens in modernity is you have the excluded middle. But when modernist missionaries went out into the world, well, people weren't giving up their excluded middle. So we'll fill them with angels and demons. But then, of course, when, for example, the Haitians were brought, you know, West Africans were brought over to Haiti, the gods kind of became Roman Catholic saints. Okay, and that's a fairly common story. It's a way of appropriating the new system and fitting it in with the old system. But you don't find that in the, you know, God stomps on the, and the Bible's always got this really, stomps on the gods of Egypt. But the Bible's always got this really interesting, this mic stand is a little cheap. The Bible is really coy on this issue. We don't find much indication of vivacious mythological battles like you see in Marvel Cinematic Universe Infinity Wars, where the Lord of Israel comes out. Now, a lot of that language is in there, and it comes out arrayed for battle. But we don't see the other gods. We don't see Marduk and Bel and Baal, and we don't have these vivid depictions of this in the Bible. You get them in other mythologies, but you don't find them in the Bible. And of course, Kaufman reads this and says, have we never asked the question why? What's going on here? And so I've just been preaching through Exodus, where, you know, God basically stomps on the gods of Egypt, but But you don't find Ra and Isis showing up in their in the forms that they show up in Egyptian temples when you don't see the Lord showing up as you hear about his arm and his shield and all of those things, but you don't see him showing up as something that Israel could make a statue of. Well, why not? Because something else is going on. And so the whole Hebrew conceptualization of this is different. And what you see, and the Bible tells this story. I mean, read Judges and Samuel. You see increasingly a centralized cult, one temple, one altar. And as you see, if you read, for example, the book of Ezekiel, this is, and archaeology bears this out too, this isn't something that was simply won and practiced and perhaps not even practiced as purely as some on the basis of reading the Bible would like to imagine in Israel. Really, until the exile, the religion of the neighbors were you know continued to be, and maybe even after the exile, continued to be a real temptation for them. But if you go back to the hurricane idea, Israel's calamities reflected in rebellion of nature against humanity and unwanted circumstance are punishment of one sovereign God. Even the destruction of this God's temple, which in the ancient world would have been seen as, you know, the ultimate throwdown of and shaming and destruction of a God. Even the destruction of Israel's temple is reflected as the act of this God. Well, the Babylonians were summoned to do it. The kingdom of Assyria was summoned to bring final judgment on the 10 northern tribes. The Romans brought judgment on. I mean, and so Israel lives in exile and wonders, when will the day of the Lord come, when the Lord will finally redeem his people, and when will a Messiah show up to get rid of these contaminating Romans and Greeks. The Maccabees did it. They were the hand of God. Cyrus is the servant of the Lord in the book of Isaiah because he restores the temple. But the second temple is not like the first temple. And so the religion of Israel casts all of these things in a strange new way. And in many ways, you can't read Genesis 1 and in some way, and read it understanding the Gilgamesh epic and all of these other stories. You can't read them and not see a proto-secularism involved, because while there is a God, you might praise God for the sun, the moon, and the stars, but you don't bow down and worship them. You might praise God for the stability of the land and the regularity of the seasons and God's providential judgment. Now I'm throwing in some medieval and some reformational theology and language into this. You don't praise those, you know, brother, sun, sister, moon. They might be our siblings, but they are not our makers. And in this way, we're going to be able to understand some other nuanced definitions of secularity that are coming through now in late modernity, early post-modernity, and to sort of be able to understand what we've been doing for the last 500 years. But in many ways, this is anticipated by this monotheistic, not an evolution of monotheism, but the monotheistic revolution that happens in Israel. And again, this is borne out, and this is a point that I've made in a number of my videos, by John Walton in Ancient Near East Thought in the Old Testament. Israel's oracles are very different from the oracles of her surrounding her neighbors. Israel indictment oracles are far more common than ancient Near East oracles. Israel oracles are most often call for covenant faithfulness, while ancient Near East oracles most often call for ritual faithfulness. You'll notice in modernist definitions of secularity and in modernism and secularism, religious rituals are downplayed, but morality is upscaled. It doesn't matter so much whether you are performing the rituals, but whether your financial or sexual house is in order, or whether you love your neighbor as yourself. You see this, again, already in ancient Israel. And so it anticipates what I think we find later on in modernity. Israel prophets are covenant enforcers, while ancient Near East prophets are ritual enforcers. Judgment in ancient Near East prophecy is nearly non-existent. In ancient Near East prophecy, divine support is often in focus. In Israelite prophecy, divine disfavor is often in focus in opposition to the status quo. Ancient Near East prophecy often majors on ritual prescription. Israelite prophecy holds covenant accountability rather than ritual accountability, and the prescription, covenant faithfulness, is the presumed remedy. Israelite hope is offered after judgment comes. Ancient Near East prophecy offers hope in near-term victory in support of the king. It's very corrupt in the sense that it's always in favor of the present regime. Israelite judgment is always critiquing the present regime. And again, this plays out in Christianity. Why the incessant self-critique of Christianity? And this is on both right and left in the political sphere. The right, we're not nearly as moral enough in their definition of moral. The left, we're not moral enough in their definition of moral. But this incessant self-critique, it comes from the ancient Near East. It comes from the prophets of the Hebrew prophets. Ancient Near East prophecy functions in a context of immediacy and urgency with no long-term value. It's in the now. Israelite prophecy is presented as part of a divine plan that is eschatological and covenant-based. It's leaning towards the future. You can see that in secularity. Secularity is always bending towards the future. The now is gone and irrelevant, and we live looking forward. While Israelite prophecy sometimes offers future telling, it is more interesting in revealing God. It's most interested in revealing God. Its goal is the people of God and offers a vision of the person and plan of God. Ancient Near East prophecy usually serves to legitimate the present king. Okay, Brett, back to the broader pagan, at this point, let's call it Gentile world, because pagan is a word that gets used in late antiquity because the cities are becoming overwhelmingly Christian in late antiquity, early medieval period. But Rome in the second and third century, before that, Rome, when Rome conquered the world, Rome unified the world. Okay, now on our perspective, not the whole world, but a lot of their world. It was her religion that accomplished this because, I mean, the world was the city, the civitas, civilization. Rome had united the world or a lot of their world. It was her religion that had accomplished this. Now, again, it was Rome's morality, but her faithfulness in ritual sacrifice that accomplishes this. And again, you see these tensions in the Old Testament. I mean, the tensions between sort of these two sides, between ritual and between heaven and earth, secular, you know, religious and secular, between ritual and regular life. You know, when Solomon consecrates the temple, you know, sacrifices 1,000 bulls. And so what you see in Ezekiel, and you can go back to my Sunday school lessons in Ezekiel, what you see in Ezekiel is that, well, it's heaven and earth. The temple, you know, Protestant terms, it's Sunday and the rest of the week. Sabbath, you know, it's temple and field that have to be united. It's sacrifice and obedience that have to be united. But Rome very much saw her supremacy as, you know, they in many ways, you know, took over Greek thought, but they still imagined themselves superior because they beat the Greeks. The Greeks had all this thinking, but, you know, short of Alexander the Great, once he dies, they fall apart into fractious groups, but Rome, because they're divided, can now conquer them, and Rome rules the world. Rome is able to unify the world, and did so under the power of her gods, and the power of her sacrifices, her temple systems, and so, you know, to be a good Roman, you honor your ethnic god, you honor your local god, and you honor the imperial gods and the imperial cult, and that's the power and the supremacy and the dominance of their administration is validated by the military victories that Roman legions win again and again. Rome's, you know, we look at it, well, Roman religion spread because her armies won. That's how we look at it. They look at it, our armies won because our gods paid attention because our sacrifices were properly done. Y'all are getting wobbly on your ritual and your sacrifice, but our sacrifice and our liturgy are properly done. And therefore, that's why our armies win. You know, Sun Tzu, wars are won in the temple, not on the battlefield. They're played out on the battlefield, or in Jonathan Pichot language, they're laid out on, the pattern is laid out on the battlefield, but the pattern is won in the temple. And in many ways, the liturgical traditions of the church, the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic still bear this out. Protestants are playing games in the mind with all of our preaching and all of our words, but, you know, doesn't matter if anybody's seeing the prayers or the liturgy or the sacraments or what's happening. Why are in these dark spaces behind the altar? I mean, all of these issues, they're all there in these tensions. So the power of their gods and the devotion to their gods, their temple system afforded the victory of the armies. Now we look at it and say, oh no, it was their superior technology and their tactics, and well, we're secular people. We're putting the one ahead of the other. Well, the Romans saw it in exactly the reverse order. Oh, what they didn't understand. They didn't understand themselves. We understand them better, looking at them through our own culture, through time, all the way back there. Really? But by late antiquity, the second and third century, the systems are breaking down. So again, flip the script. Jesus had conquered the principalities and powers, and the principalities and powers are losing strength. Well, it doesn't happen right away. It begins to happen there. Oh, that we understand. We're progressivists. We understand progressive revelation. Christianity is built in that, as is Islam and the Mormon church. By the second and third century, the systems are breaking down. Well, why? Well, partly corruption. And if you look at the Romans, so some of this I'm getting from Peter Brown's Through the Eye of a Needle, which is a really helpful book on many of these scores, also the work of Tom Holland. So Romans in late antiquity praised the virtues of their founding fathers, the, you know, Cincinnatus, who is the patrician farmer who goes off and saves the empire and then returns to the field. You know, a lot of this is built into American culture as well, partly because, you know, America was founded by classicists. You know, the founding fathers were classicists. They were steeped in the educational system founded by Erasmus. So, you know, the problem with Rome is that it was corrupt, and the Roman Republic was lost to the emperor, and virtue was lost. And so what you find in Roman emperors is they keep, you know, taking on the language of republican virtues. No, I'm not emperor, but you are. You see this game being played in American politics now. Whether you're looking at, you know, from, really it starts with Lincoln. Sorry, but it does. Lincoln, Roosevelt, Nixon, Obama, Trump, you know, more and more done by executive order. Congress, well, it's not that Congress is beaten out of its powers. Congress advocates, basically abandons its power. And so then the president keeps taking more and more. Well, it was quite a bit more bloody in the Roman period, but, you know, but yet the emperors still play the part of first citizen, you know, while they're playing other parts too. So Romans in late antiquity looked back into the Republic as, well, that's when we had virtue. Okay. An increasing threat of barbarians. The legions aren't winning like they used to, and the population isn't there, and so increasingly legions are made up of barbarians, and or is it just Roman citizens and then people of Italy? Now everybody's a Roman citizen, and so nobody's a Roman citizen. And the cultic tax was increasingly heavy. You know, as Augustine mocks them, there's the gods of the doorknob, and not just the gods of the door, or the gods of the doorway, or the gods of the mantle, but the gods of the hardware on the door, and the gods of not only the gods of the candle, but the gods of the wick. And I mean, Augustine just mocks the Roman system like that. Well, part of the problem is that there's all these gods roaming around, and you know, if you haven't paid sufficient attention to even an insignificant god by offering them the propitiating sacrifices to keep those gods happy, well, for lack of a nail, the shoe was lost. For lack of a shoe, the horse was lost. For lack of the horse, the battle was lost. And so you've got to keep covering your bases with all of these gods. And as Tom Holland notes in this lecture that I've got, that I'm pointing to here, well, It's just a cultic tax, and it's just increasingly heavy. And so what happens in the second and third century with there's just ongoing revolutions of emperor after emperor after emperor with tiny short reigns being violently overthrown and killed by another general and on and on and on and on. There's no sticking power, and they are all trying out these maybe one god to rule them all. Again, an evolutionary monotheism, maybe this one god. And Constantine picks the Hebrew God, this Jesus who, according to Paul, conquered the principalities and powers. And now, if you understand the Jewish way, you can see that this Jesus, in his background, has a very different conceptualization of the entire system by which, spiritual system by which the world is ruled. And so Constantine attempts to try this God out. And, you know, the ideas of the history, you know, has continued to, historians have been working hard on this period. This is again, from Peter Brown's Through the Eye of a Needle. Constantine did not act out of political calculation. He did not perceive that Christianity was on the way to becoming a majority religion in any part of his empire, not even in the more densely Christianized East, and certainly not in the Latin West, where Christianity seemed to have made considerably less progress. If Constantine intuited Christianity as the wave of the future, it was not in terms of the observed expansion of Christian communities. Rather, in the austere words of James Bury, Constantine's conversion had been the most audacious act ever committed by an autocrat in defiance of the vast majority of his subjects. Constantine picks Jesus because Jesus, Constantine hopes, has conquered the other gods. And so now Constantine, in a very pragmatic, efficient, economical way, can just pay one religious service provider, can just employ one vendor, the Christian clergy, to manage the Christian God and ensure that the Christian God affords him continual dominance. Well, guess what? Constantine ends this string of would-be rulers who have their pretend gods that keep getting overturned, and Constantine and his god stick, all the way through to Constantinius, his son. In return for this protection, Constantine rewarded the Christian clergy with appropriate privileges. for it was they, and not the average Christian, who were the ritual experts. Okay? Why do they now need appropriate and proper churches with proper art? And why does Constantine call these councils to get their act together? Now, was Jesus the son of, was Jesus God too? Or was he adopted? Or what's Jesus' relation? I mean, we've got to get this right, because if we don't get this right, our armies lose. Touch the mic. If we don't get this right, our armies lose. This was as maneuvering to maintain his power as Richard Nixon or Donald Trump. Some of you aren't going to hate that statement, but there be it. Ask John Bolton. Furthermore, in order to enjoin the continued protection of his God, Constantine was prepared to devote great pains to keeping the worship of that God immune from error and division. Why does Constantine call councils? Because, well, he's just a theology nerd. He's not a theology nerd because he's a nerd. He's interested in theology because he's a general. And he understands power, and he wants to maintain it. He wants to hand it down to his son. And he understands, as every other Roman emperor before him understood, power is about dealing with the gods. Well, now there's some secularity. There's some Stoicism involved. Okay, let's give Stoicism its due. But the majority position, why is the ancient world so covered in temples? Why is Athens so covered in altars? Why is North America so covered in power plants and shopping malls and industries and police stations? These are the ways we ensure our dominance and maintain ourselves and maintain order. That's what ritual did in the ancient pagan Gentile world. But now, Jewish Christianity, you got one foot in ritual, you got one foot in obedience. And the church, similarly, they're not only performing rituals, they're feeding the poor. Christianity's got both things going. From 312 to his death in 337, Constantine and then his son Constantius, 337 to 61, patrolled the Christian episcopate ceaselessly to make sure that the worship they offered to God was correct and pleasing to him. You've got to keep God happy. You've got, anybody who has a patron understands, keep your patron happy, because you only enjoy your privileges as long as the patron continues to give you theirs. Little fun fact about Dominican history of the Dominican Republic. Trujillo, the dictator in the middle of the 20th century, part of his downfall, well, very clearly he said, in heaven God, on earth Trujillo. The church at one point basically removes its support of Trujillo when Trujillo claimed himself to be the patron of the patria. Notice all the Latin there, all the language. This is Latin America. This stuff communicates through culture. And the church said, no, God is our patron, not you, Trujillo. And Trujillo went down. Now the dualities in maintaining harmony between heaven and earth multiply and continue. Israel's God placed cultic demands upon her. And in fact, at the beginning of Israel's story, by what power are the Jews saved from the coming of the day of the Lord over Egypt? Because of the blood of the Lamb painted on the mantle, on the doorpost. And roasting the lamb, internal organs and all, upon an open fire with your robes tucked in, ready to go when the signal is given, ready to be liberated from Egypt and sack Egypt without swords, just going up to the wealthy neighbors and say, give me my reparations for slavery. And they offer them freely. Now, of course, after you're gone, they're going to send the army, but the Lord takes care of that too. Later, the Hebrew prophets, our Lord wants obedience, not sacrifice. Covenant faithfulness was living out a vision of life symbolized in the temple, the sacred, and fleshed out in the seculum, the secular world. Gentile emperors, pagan emperors, were the pontiffs. They were the bridge between heaven and earth. That's what the emperor did. That's what Constantine was. But now Constantine is going to have to share. You know, so the bridge through which divine powers manifest. That's what Pharaoh is. That's how empire works. That's why the Lord comes and stomps on Pharaoh and all of his gods. And Pharaoh comes out with his army, and the Lord says, I'm going to keep Israel here to lure your army out. They're going to go through on dry land, and I'm going to flood y'all. Death by water? Merely pragmatic? No, deeply symbolic. Traditionally, priests were servants of the king emperor. And, you know, just read the book of Daniel. But priests don't give me answers that I want. Off with their heads. Wise men, magi. That's what Daniel was, probably a eunuch. The job of the priest class was to manage the relationship with the gods through the cult. And this is why ancient Near East oracles and Roman oracles, this is why you don't give the emperor bad news, because he just replaces the priests. Well, and people begin to look at that and say, ah, that's corruption. Because if the gods are really in charge, and if the priests really know what the god says, well, you'd better protect these priests. And again, Constantine is affording, and again, read Peter Brown on this, because it's nuanced, and it's very interesting. It's a very interesting story. But the Christian God conquers through self-sacrifice. This Jesus, everybody expects him to ride a war horse and carry a sword like you'll find him in the book of Revelation. But he conquers through the blood of the Lamb. He conquers in a Passover way. And the church acts this out in service to the poor. And so the council of bishops become a second bridge. They become the pontiffs. And I keep using this word pontiffs. Why do you keep using this word pontiffs? Why are you talking about the Pope? How do you think he gets the name? Now, the breakdown of the pagan empire and the rise of popes and kings. The empire is lost, and now you have a patchwork of kingdoms, but many of the kingdoms are looking to King Jesus for their dominion, for their power, for their energy. Well, there's got to be a concentration of it. Well, you find it in the church. Well, you find it in the clergy. You find it in the priests. But a hierarchy then develops, and the Pope. Why is the Pope of Rome? Why does the Pope in Rome imagine he can excommunicate all the Eastern patriarchs? Well, in some ways, the system continues to hold together better in the East much longer, and it falls apart in the West. But that falling apart basically leaves the pontiffs, or the Pope of Rome, as the last man standing, and all of these disparate kingdoms underneath him. This just sets up the tension between kings and popes that, if you read Tom Holland's The Forge of Christendom or Millennium, I saw at one point, I saw, there's a Tom Holland book I don't have. I don't have his vampire book. But there's a Tom Holland book I don't have. So I bought the book, and it was an English copy. And then I wrote Tom, and Tom says, yeah, in England they call it Millennium. In the U.S., The Forge of Christendom. The publisher's things, I'm sure. But that begins with this epic scene between Henry IV and Gregory at Canossa, where Henry has to come and beg to be let back into the church because Pope Gregory has excommunicated him and is threatening his ability to be emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. But of course, there's France, there's England, there's Spain, there'll be lots of other, we haven't talked about nation states rising yet, and that's a part of the story coming up, although I'm not going to talk about it much. It's these perpetual struggles between pontiffs and council. In some ways, similar to the struggles between emperor and council. And again, this is going to be played out in the Reformation, where, well, basically, German princes why do we send all that money to Rome so that they can build these cathedrals and these monuments and these frescoes and these works of art? What do those works of art do? We're listening to the Hebrew, you know, Martin Luther's listening to the Hebrew prophets. We want obedience, not sacrifice. And you can see all of this stuff subtly migrate. Now, you had a classical medieval synthesis, Platonism and Augustine, Aristotle and Aquinas, one church with seven sacraments. But Europe is changing. It's technology, the printing press develops, urbanization. The plague comes through and sort of like a California forest fire and clears out the population underbrush. And now suddenly labor is more expensive and nobility is tottering. And, you know, some ideas, some egalitarian ideas are rising more and more. And they're looking for a new base. So then Europe gets plunged into, first you have the rise of the text where, you know, we learn physics by reading Aristotle, and we learn morality by the morality side of the text will continue far later. But we learn, you know, how to gain our power by following God and by having right worship. And while we're looking for a new basis for unity, when that plunges Europe, the Protestant Catholic Reformational Wars plunges Europe into blood. And so Europe is looking for a new basis for unity. And now they have it. Heaven is reason and earth is nature. And so deism begins to develop. C.S. Lewis laments in The Discarded Image, the classical medieval synthesis gets destroyed by deism, basically, and the science that deism fosters. Now there's a new way to know God, and it's not in holy books or in holy temples, although all of the new scientists are Christians, or at least within Christendom. But what does it mean to be a Christian now? Well, before, what it meant to be a Christian was to practice Christian liturgy and have Christian practices. Now, those of you who are paying attention to the church scene, your ears will perk up. Christian practice? Christian disciplines? Christian tradition? We're having Eucharist. Protestants are calling it Eucharist, and we're having it every week, and we're paying more attention to liturgy. But we're doing it in a psychological way now. Now we call it formation. We're not seeking the God's favor to have this source of power come down and help our armies win. That's Pat Robertson. Now it's psychological and we're being formed as Christians. So now we can psychologically embody and inhabit. So modernity is in there and postmodernity is in there. God spoke with one voice through nature, and math is its language. The validation of truth. Now, the word truth itself will have another evolving definition. Okay, is truth, is your aim true, a la Jordan Peterson, to hit the target, or is truth a correspondence theory between I have five fingers and the idea of five? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So, five fingers true. Ask Aristotle how many teeth women had. Were women unavailable that Aristotle couldn't count them? What was Aristotle doing when he was talking about how many teeth women had? When we read Aristotle, are we really understanding him? So the validation of truth, evolving definition, could be seen beyond biblical interpretation. They're fighting and killing each other because they can't agree on what the text says. You know, Sam Harris makes this argument when he talks to Jordan Peterson. That's how enduring these ideas are. So the validation of truth, Protestants and Catholics, well, their math is the same. Water freezes at the same temperature for Protestants and Catholics. Protestants and Catholics, Voltaire notes, they might fight in church councils, but they make nice in the marketplace because they both like money. Technology would validate this to the masses. in due time. And then there's the Lisbon earthquake in 1775. Where was God for the beginning of the modern problem of evil? The Enlightenment philosophers rush in and say, this wasn't God's judgment on Lisbon. The Enlightenment philosophers, they're Christians. This wasn't God's judgment on Lisbon. This was just the product of nature. And maybe if we build our cities better, and maybe if we can understand the patterns of nature, maybe we'll be able to predict the earthquake and the tsunami and the fire, and maybe we can avoid these disasters. And well, you can find the beginnings of the modern world right there, can't you? Jay Inslee, for as progressive and woke as he wants to be, speaks pure modernism. These are not just wildfires, because now nature will, all of these terms, nature, truth, secularity, these are like the constants that Rupert Sheldrake talks about. They're not constant. You need an office, you need a bureaucracy to maintain the constants. And just Sheldrake says, if it's a constant, shouldn't the bureaucracy be based on the constant and not the constant dependent on the bureaucracy? There's human fingerprints all over this science stuff, Sheldrake says. He's got a point. These are not just wildfires. They are climate fires. They are political fires, Inslee says. And we cannot and we will not surrender our state and expose our people to have their homes burned down and lives lost because of climate fires. Oh. Okay. But in a sense, what you're saying is we've made climate our bitch, or we've made nature our bitch. And, you know, the doggy is acting up. And so if we're a little nicer to the doggy, if we can train the doggy, if we can manage the doggy, then the doggy will give us what we want. We're going to make nature our pet. But now, is nature our mother or is nature our pet? Impacts of the climate change are not 20 or 30 years away, Inslee says. Already too many towns have burned down, the governor says, and he looked forward to a state being unified to fight this scourge. Not with forest management, where we're going to do that too. So that's nature and science-y and stuff. But we're going to stop forest fires because we're going to change the climate. Well, tell me exactly how you're going to get Africa and Asia to reduce their, and Latin America to reduce their climate emissions? When they say, hey, whitey, colonialist, they listen too. It's not like we have these secret words that only we can use to demythologize. And, you know, once other people figure out what language you're using to beat on each other, white person between privileged, white person between privileged, white person, you think they're not going to employ it when it serves their advantage? It's just silly. This is not natural. This is not an act of God, Inslee says. This is happening because we have changed the climate in the state of Washington in dramatic ways. Oh, I'm sorry. Does climate observe the borders of the state of Washington? Or is there one global climate? And do we need... Oh, now I'm really going to trigger some things. Do we need one world government to address the climate change issue? Do we need climate tyranny? See, Jay Inslee is speaking Enlightenment. He doesn't know it. He's not being a good ally to his cause, because anybody who thinks this through is going to say, you're going to have to get colonial all over again and go make the rest of the world submit to your new theology, your theology of climate change. You've got to get the rest of the world to submit to that, or else. Well, maybe we can convince them of that. Yeah, I certainly would prefer that to nuclear intimidation. Doesn't he know that climate change is white supremacy? Jay, pay attention to your words. What's the definition of secular? Well, religious versus secular. Religion has gods, holy books, and myths. Secular has science, facts, and public space. Secular means religion-free. Religion is this husk that we've discarded. Oh no, No, you've just made other things your religion. Modern liberalism is dying and the IDW can't save it. Postmodern assault on math and science will continue and in some ways win. That's terrifying. It's terrifying James Lindsay. It's terrifying Brett Weinstein. Terrifies Jordan Peterson. It terrifies people in the university. They have a right to be terrified because, you know, the Enlightenment and the deism and modernism has its point. And again, right now everybody's looking, well, we need a vaccine. Yeah, we do need a vaccine. But standpoint epistemology also has a point. And at some point, you're going to have both of these points make sense in a world together. And that's really the challenge. Because gravity, even if its constant fluctuates, is still real. And science is still valid. It's still useful. It still does things. But it's blind to some things. And the manifest image and the scientific image, you're going to have to try and figure out how these two eyes work together. And this is going to take centuries. And a lot of lives may be lost in along the way, just like a lot of lives were lost in the modern period to get to the height of modernity. Science and math won't disappear, but rather be relativized as human enterprises, which they've always been. Or should I say recognized as human enterprises, which they've always been. Math may be really helpful in understanding my dog, but my dog does not do math. And this is where, again, we get into David Sloan Wilson, and he basically owns GadSad here. And David Sloan Wilson, he's got a strong point. His point is similar to Brett Weinstein, but I think he's seeing beyond Brett. You can't understand human beings without a deeply communal, symbolic imaginary that fuels both competition and cooperation. In other words, well, what is religion? Well, are we going to define this word? Modernity couldn't define it. The ancients didn't even know they were doing it. Well, it's this symbolic, dramatic imaginary that we use to understand the world. And we use in order to, as human beings, cooperate and compete in the world. Well, what about the sacrifices? Yeah, they were key. Well, what about the secular? Yeah, it's key. Well, how do the sacrifices and the secular work together? Now we're knocking on the right door. God says, I'm a purist. If it isn't true, then why are you talking? Why do you deal with other human beings? Because you can't deal with other human beings without the symbolic, dramatic imaginary. The language is full of it. Everything we do between human beings is full of it. We dream it. This is where Jordan Peterson comes in. This Jordan saw this. He had some of the language for it, but this is the point. And Jordan got it through Jung. It's always been with us. We just don't know ourselves. I mean, why is it that we can't define religion or life or secular or true, yet we're all using these words and, you know, using them in a sloshy way, 70-80%, we sort of know what we're talking about. In this video, all GadSad does is continue to confess his modernist confession. So redefining secularity, Tom Holland and many others jump in and say, well, Jesus remade the world permanently. He really did. You see it in Constantine. And the thing is, it didn't just, not just in the churches, but in the imaginary and in fact, secularity. In that chapter, I was writing that chapter in March, and it began to dawn on me that in some ways, secularity is the church's secret sister. And whereas in India they rejected the church, they embraced her sister. In Japan, many reject the church but embrace her sister. But the sister secular doesn't reign fully either. And I'm gonna have to dig into and use this metaphor quite a bit more. It's in the chapter. That's when I thought of it. But I think it's the right way to think of it. Maybe I'll read some of the chapter at some point. It's coming out in the book. We'll see what the editors do with it. See, Stephen Smith makes a contribution here. And again, I'm not fully down. He's the author of Pagan Christians in the City. I'm not fully down with his definite. I'm going to see if this. It's interesting because in the one screen it's backwards, and in the other screen it's correct. It's correct in the correct screen, so that's fine. What do we mean by secular? And Steve Smith begins by saying, you know, that the definition that we have isn't planning out. That the script that all the modernists imagine, that religion as we imagine it to be will just sordidly fade away, that's just bunk. And if you still believe that, you're just not paying attention. Look at Clay Rutledge. Look at Tara Isabella Burton. Just look at your neighbor when they stop going to church and, you know, double down on the astrology. This is how we're made. Boys and girls, it ain't going to stop. It's because of this symbolic, dramatic imaginary. So, and so Stephen Smith says, you know, paganism never really left. And he's exactly right with that. So how can we talk about this and how can we track this? He says, well, track the secular. And that's not new to him or original to him. But he says, watch the location of the secular. Track the sacred. Watch the location of the sacred. Is the sacred down here in the world? Or is the sacred in the heavenlies? What do you mean by that? Well, paganism was, in a sense, about my best life now. And in some ways, Jesus is about the coming kingdom. Now, there needs to be a ton of nuance with that. Because plenty of non-Christian religions, even non-Abrahamic religions, you know, lean into the afterlife to do a lot of duty. And Christianity isn't purely transcendental. It's also deeply immanent. God number one and God number two. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. Transcendence. The whole earth is full of his glory. Immanence. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. The Bible is about the reconciliation of heaven and earth. You can read about that in the book of Revelation. That's how the story ends. How does the story begin? The story begins the creation of heaven and earth, the breach of heaven from earth in Genesis 3, and then the reconciliation of heaven and earth in the book of Revelation. It's the story of the Bible. But the pagan Christian battle has been going on ever since. And Stephen Smith's idea, which I think is a powerful one, says paganism, Christianity doesn't really beat paganism, but paganism is now probably parasitic and dependent upon Christianity. And again, you can throw Platonism in there and you can throw other pieces in there, but I'm going to have to continue to think about Stephen Smith's. Maybe I'll get a chance to talk to him. It's nice when people don't have a million YouTube followers. So I send them an email, say, hey, I'm a YouTuber, and you got any time? I want to do a conversation about a project that you clearly like. I only like doing conversations with high-profile people when I know something about what they're talking about. So hopefully we can have a productive conversation. But as I found out in my conversation with Tom Holland, it doesn't necessarily mean, because it's nice if they know something about you. This is why the conversations between myself and Jonathan and John are really very special, because we all sort of know each other's work a bit. And if Jordan ever jumps into the game, that'll get really fun. But the kingdom without the king. Mark Sawyers is using that terminology, and he's looking at secularism in a different light. But he's a pastor, and he's talking with pastors. And so, whereas I'm not really sure about his historical philosophical matrix in which he's working with this, but in terms of how it applies to the church. So there's a podcast, This Cultural Moment, where there's a pastor from Portland and Mark Sayers, where they have quite a few conversations, and I'll put the link to that podcast in the notes. I've been working my way through it. But also, again, Andrew Root. Now, Andrew Root is interesting because he's the kind of academic who also knows practice. And again, whereas I think I'm going to disagree with him on some of the prescriptions, partly because I'm pretty sure I don't know the way forward. I think he's really doing terrific service in interpreting Charles Taylor for us. So, yeah, there'll be more on this. This is basically what I'm chewing on lately in minutes that I don't have to do church work or help my wife make videos or all these kinds of things. And so, back to the question, what is secular? Why is, on one hand, well, the wildfires are God's judgments. Again, these very pagan states, California, Oregon, Washington. Or is this, are we sinners in the hands of an angry climate change? Sinners in the hands of an angry climate. And Jay Inslee, no, this is not nature. Nature's supposed to be our pet. Because nature is supposed to, basically, in his worldview, nature is supposed to serve the secret sacred self, which are, in some ways, our appetites. And we're going to forget that ourselves are formed. We're going to forget that we've learned Freud and Jung and psychology and sociology. We're going to turn a blind eye to, we're going to have some willful blindness with respect to that. We're going to imagine that there's this spiritual pure fount that has somehow been marred. I mean, it's pagan. But no ancient pagan would ever have imagined nature to be our pet. In fact, in many ways, the ancient pagans approached the gods in order to tame nature because they knew nature was going to rip us to shreds, red in tooth and claw. So that's where we're going. That's where we're at. How long has this video been? I don't know. I chopped it up into segments, probably long enough, but it's what I have time for today. So thanks for watching. Hope you enjoy it.